So in our passage this evening, Mark chapter 15, verses 33-39, we have Mark concluding his account, really, of the earthly ministry of Jesus Christ. And he concludes it with those great words of the centurion in verse 39, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." After all that centurion has seen, after all that he's heard, and especially after the way in which Jesus has died and what he's observed of that, this is what he says: "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Now, as it happens, the phrase, the expression "Son of God" is quite rare in Mark's Gospel. In fact, actually, this is the only time it's spoken by a human being, except for the narrator Mark himself at the beginning of this book, and for people who are possessed by demons. But at the same time, I do think we have a very significant theme here in Mark's Gospel: the divine sonship of Jesus Christ. It's a theme which almost, we could say, frames the entire Gospel of Mark. Remember how this gospel begins. It begins with that great opening statement, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And at various points in this gospel, although the words "Son of God" are not used often, the theme certainly of God, of Christ's sonship, his divine sonship, it crops up again and again. And so for that reason, then, I think that this moment here in verse 39 of chapter 15, this statement of the centurion, it's actually very significant, because it acts as a climax of this great theme which has been building since the beginning of this gospel, the divine sonship of Christ. And this evening I just want to try and show you that a bit more clearly. And this is how I want to do it. I want us to consider this passage in the light of three previous moments in Mark's Gospel. Basically, I want to take this passage, and this particularly this great moment in verse 39, and I want you to see how it is deriving its full force, really, from the whole story of Mark's Gospel, the whole story which precedes it, and in particular, three earlier moments in Mark's Gospel. And it's these three earlier moments that I want us to consider this evening under three headings. And so firstly then, I want us to view this passage in the light of the Transfiguration. In the light of the Transfiguration. I want to begin by thinking about the relationship between the events of this passage and the events that took place on that other mountain back in chapter 9, the Mount of Transfiguration. Because you see, at first sight, there's an enormous gulf, is there not, between Christ's transfiguration and Christ's crucifixion. Those two events could not seem more different. And basically, the difference is this: the transfiguration is an occasion where God expresses his great pleasure in his Son. The crucifixion is an occasion where, at least on the face of things, that divine pleasure is replaced with divine displeasure. Think about it. There are some striking contrasts, aren't there? At the Transfiguration, God's pleasure is expressed in light. Christ's clothes become radiant, Mark says, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. But here at the crucifixion, we are smothered in darkness, aren't we? From the sixth hour to the ninth hour, Mark says, darkness covers the land. Clearly, this is the darkness of divine displeasure. It's an unnatural darkness. It's a supernatural darkness. It's the darkness of judgment, I think. It's the same darkness we see several other places in the Old Testament, in particular the darkness of Exodus chapter 10, where a darkness that can be felt, as it's described there, falls over the land of Egypt. Then again, at the Transfiguration, God's pleasure is expressed in noise. The voice of a loving father booming out of the clouds: "This is my beloved Son." In Matthew's gospel, he adds, "with whom I am well pleased." At the crucifixion, heaven is silent. There's no response to Jesus' cries. He makes these cries to his Father, but there's no answer from heaven. At the transfiguration, God's pleasure is expressed in company. Moses and Elijah talk with Jesus on the mountain. You can imagine them comforting Jesus, reassuring Jesus, putting their arms around Jesus perhaps, encouraging him for what lies ahead. At the crucifixion, we have complete and utter loneliness, don't we? At one point, the people think he's calling Elijah. They even make space for Elijah to appear. They say in verse 36, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. But Elijah doesn't turn up this time. Jesus is left completely on his own. And finally then, at the transfiguration, God's pleasure is clearly expressed in the majesty of Jesus Christ. Jesus is physically transfigured on the mountain. "We were eyewitnesses of his majesty," that's what Peter says. But at the crucifixion, Jesus does not look majestic. There's no transfiguration. If anything, we have the opposite. We have a disfiguration. And so all of the evidence is pointing in the same direction, isn't it? If the transfiguration speaks about God's pleasure towards Jesus, the crucifixion clearly speaks of God's displeasure towards Jesus. This is a man who is abandoned by God. This is a man who is forsaken by God. This is a man who is accursed by God, hanging on a tree, as we read in Deuteronomy. And if Elijah hasn't turned up to comfort him, it's because Elijah has no business comforting this man. It would not be appropriate for this man to be comforted by Elijah right now. You might even say this man does not deserve Elijah's comfort. Because here is a man, at least on the face of things, with whom God could not be more displeased. And if you think I'm taking it too far, well, Jesus knows that I'm not. Jesus says, doesn't he, himself, in verse 34, he speaks out those great words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus isn't mistaken when he utters those words. Jesus is under no illusion about his condition. Unless you want to say Jesus is a liar now, you have to agree with him, don't you? This is a man who really is forsaken by God. He is suffering under divine displeasure. And for that reason, at first sight, it appears to be the complete opposite of what we have at the Transfiguration. We could not be further away from that beautiful mountain now. But it's at this point that I want to notice a few things with you. Firstly, we need to see that for all this passage is bleak, there does come a point where something changes. It changes in verse 37, where Jesus breathes his last. Jesus has declared himself forsaken, but then something happens. Some people put a sponge on a stick, and Jesus, it seems like he's wetting his mouth, preparing to say something. And then in verse 37, he does something. He utters a loud cry, and he breathes his last. Now, Mark doesn't tell us what Jesus says in that loud cry. We know what it is from other Gospels, but whatever he's saying, the impression that we get here is that this is deliberate. It's a deliberate moment. It's a purposeful moment. It's a cry that seems to bring his life to an end. It's a cry which perhaps even brings this darkness to an end, given that the darkness, we're told, lasts until the ninth hour, and this cry is made at the ninth hour. And so, in verse 37, we're not just presented anymore with a dying Jesus, we're presented with a Jesus who dies deliberately, decisively, we could even say triumphantly. In the next passage, we see that Pilate himself is very surprised that Jesus died so quickly. So this is a Jesus who dies with all of the purpose and all of the authority that he's ever possessed in this gospel. The same authority with which he commands the waves to be still and he heals the sick, that seems to be the authority which he's possessing in that moment. He's giving up his life purposefully, decisively, triumphantly. And so that's the first thing I just want to notice in this passage. But after that, then, there's a second thing I want to notice. And it's this, that when it comes to this centurion, he doesn't simply see divine displeasure over Jesus, does he? Now, when this centurion sees Jesus cry out and breathe his last, well, what does he say in verse 39? He says, truly this man was the Son of God. You see, the way Jesus dies tells this centurion that he's witnessed something unique. I mean, this is a man who has seen criminals dying plenty of times before, but when he sees Jesus breathing his last, he knows that he has not just witnessed the death of one of those other criminals. In short, this man somehow knows that he has not just witnessed an angry God forsaking a sinful man, though that is what he has witnessed. He has also witnessed an obedient son serving a loving father. A son of God. A son who, despite all of the pain and all of the agony, is now at the end of his life able to cry out in power and triumph and then resign his spirit into the care of his loving father. And so it's almost as if this centurion, there's a moment there where he's able to peer through all of the darkness of Calvary and say, not truly this man was the enemy of God, but actually truly this man was the Son of God. And that then brings me to the third thing that I want us to notice. And this really is my central point here, and it's this. That in those few words of this centurion, he has actually drawn a line now between this dark mountain of crucifixion and that bright mountain of transfiguration. And why is that? Well, it's because this centurion now speaks that very same truth that we last heard booming from the mountain of transfiguration, and actually the truth that we first heard booming from heaven at Christ's baptism, and indeed the same truth which in a sense will be declared at Christ's resurrection. This is the Son of God. This is the beloved Son of God in whom the Father takes pleasure. And when you see the passage in that light, when we sort of follow the centurion's hyperlink back to those passages where Christ's sonship is declared, we realize that whatever else might be happening here, however abandoned and forsaken this man might be, even if he really is under God's displeasure, and he is, somewhere on the other side of that darkness, there is still a father who is smiling down upon his beloved son, just like he was at his baptism, just like he will be at his resurrection, just like he was at his transfiguration. That constant has not changed. And so while everyone else might look at Jesus and mock, this centurion reminds us that Jesus has a father that is just as pleased with his son as he ever was. And indeed, in one sense, we could say that even now he is even more pleased, because this son has now served his father to the uttermost. And so I'm just sort of bringing this mystery to your attention. In one sense, things could not be darker for Jesus. The full displeasure of God is being poured down upon him. He is embodying our sins. He is representing us in our sinful state. He is taking the wrath of God completely and fairly and justly. He is suffering under the agony of that. But at the same time, at this very moment, in a mysterious sense, things could not be brighter. Because that constant has not changed. This is the Son of God serving his Father like he was supposed to. And all heaven behind those dark clouds now beams with approval and adoration upon this man with whom God is well pleased. And so view this passage in the light of the Transfiguration. and recall them that we have nevertheless a God who is happy and loving and deeply approving and celebrating, in a sense, of the great act of service which his Son is rendering to him. See a Jesus who hasn't failed. See a Jesus who dies in triumph, the Son of God, and he does it with the full approval of heaven above. So view this passage in the light of the Transfiguration. But secondly, view this passage in light of the tenets. In light of the tenets. That sounds like a strange thing to say, so I will explain myself. So the second passage I want us to cast our mind back to in Mark's Gospel is chapter 12 and the parable of the tenants. And let me just remind you how that parable goes. I won't read it out to you, but it's quite an easy story to tell. So let me just remind you, Jesus tells this story of a man who builds a vineyard and he leases it to some tenants. And then because this man who's built this vineyard, because he wants to enjoy the produce of his vineyard, he sends a servant to the vineyard, to the tenants, to collect some of the fruit, the grapes. But what happens? Well, the tenant beats the first servant and sends him away empty-handed. And then the man sends another servant. But this one is beaten again and he's treated shamefully. And so he sends another one. And this one is killed. And so it goes on. Some are beaten and some are killed. And what is the meaning of this parable? Well, it's very simple. The man in the story represents God. The vineyard in the story represents Israel. The tenants are the leaders and keepers of Israel. And the servants who are being sent to them are God's prophets sent to Israel. And the point is, Jesus is saying, look, for hundreds of years, God has been persistently gracious to the people of Israel. He's given them a land. He's given them a commission, he's given them a purpose, and then after that he's given them a whole stream of prophets. And yet the people, and particularly the Jewish leaders, have acted wickedly. They have exploited the grace of God, they have lived for themselves, and time again they have resisted and persecuted and even killed the prophets who were sent to them, just like those servants. And so the parable, it ends with Jesus threatening the judgment of God upon Israel. But you see, the parable of the tenants doesn't stop there. The parable cranks up a notch, doesn't it? See, Jesus doesn't simply end his parable condemning those past generations of Jewish leaders for resisting the prophets in the past. No, he does something else. He goes a step further and he condemns the current generation. He condemns the very people he's speaking to for something much, much worse than the killing of the prophets. Let me read from Mark chapter 12, verse 6. Jesus says, he's speaking in the parable now, the owner of the vineyard, had still one other, a beloved son. Finally, he sent him to them, saying, they will respect my son. But those tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. And they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. So past generations of the Jewish leaders might have killed the prophets of God, but the current generation, the very men to whom Jesus is speaking, they will soon be killing the Son of God. So what's the relevance of this passage to Mark chapter 15? Well, here's the thing. Now that we've reached Mark chapter 15, this centurion tells us that that is precisely what is now happening. The man who has just died on that cross was that beloved son who was sent by his father to the vineyard. That is what this centurion is reminding us. And so what will that mean for the tenants of the vineyard? What will that mean for the men who put him on the cross? It will mean judgment. Judgment on the vineyard. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. And when you go back over the chapters which follow Mark chapter 12, you see there that Jesus spells out what this judgment will be like. And very simply, within the pages of history, it will mean judgment on the city of Jerusalem, judgment on the privileged positions which these leaders currently occupy, and judgment especially on their beloved temple. Jesus says, doesn't he? Do you see these great buildings? They will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And what will happen after that? Well, in the parable, we're told that new people will be brought in to inherit the vineyard. And Jesus tells us in the following chapters what that means spelled out in history. And he talks about the construction of a new temple in the place of the old temple. And how does Jesus end the parable of the tenants? Well, in Mark chapter 12, verse 10, he says this: "Have you not read this scripture? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." Jesus will be that new temple. The rejected cornerstone will now be the foundation of that new temple. And so all of that will be the judgment upon Israel for murdering none other than the Son of God. A murder that this centurion tells us is now taking place in chapter 15. You know, when we're told that this darkness is over the land from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, I think we're right, as we said before, that this is the darkness of judgment upon Jesus. But I wonder whether that darkness also sort of foretells of another judgment. I mean, remember how back in chapter 13, verse 24, Jesus is speaking about the judgment upon Israel in the temple, and he speaks of it in these prophetic terms: "The sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from the heaven." That's Jesus using dramatic language, warning the Jews about what was soon to come within the space of a generation. And I think we see perhaps even a foretaste of that at the cross. It's not the only sign of judgment in this passage upon Israel. You look at that incredible dramatic moment in verse 38 where the temple curtain is torn in two from top to bottom. And we often talk about that as symbolizing the access that we have to God, no longer through a human temple, now through the work of Jesus Christ. And I think that's true, and I think that is, you can defend that idea biblically, even from within the book of Mark. But I don't think that's all which is going on. We need to remember, don't we, that the temple in Mark's gospel is often seen as this institution which has fallen into sin and will soon be judged. And so I think when we see that tearing of the curtain, perhaps it is an indication that God is expressing his displeasure upon his people and upon the temple for what they have done in murdering his son. It's interesting, isn't it, that it's at that moment when the centurion makes that remark, "Truly this man is the Son of God." Obviously he doesn't witness the curtain being torn. But the fact that he says it directly after it happens does sort of suggest that the sequence is important, doesn't it? So it's almost as if this centurion he's just watched the unthinkable take place. He sees the tenants killing and beating the son of the owner of the vineyard. And for a time it might have looked like they were getting away with it. But now he sees the sky is turning black. And yes, there might be another 40 years before the Romans march in and destroy that temple. But even now, judgment upon it has begun. That first rip through the curtain has taken place by no less than the hand of God himself. And so this centurion looks upon all of that and he says, "Truly this man was the Son of God." As if he's saying, don't they know who they've just killed? They've just killed God's only son. Surely, surely we haven't heard the last of this. And it's a reminder to us, isn't it, of the great tragedy of what it is to live a life in rejection of the Son of God. Historically speaking, the destruction of that temple, the invasion of Jerusalem, which would take place 40 years later, that was, if we're to take Jesus' words seriously, an act of judgment from God upon the people for rejecting and killing his son. But it may be that you in this room this evening, you haven't killed the Son of God physically, but in your heart you still reject him. You resist him. You do not want him. You, in a sense, put him to death in your life. You turn away from him. And I want you to take the words of this centurion seriously. This man who you're rejecting, he is the Son of God. He is the Son of God. And you will not get away with your rejection of him. Please, if that is you, turn to that Son of God on that cross and worship him like that centurion. So we want to view this passage in the light of the Transfiguration, in the light of the tenants, and then thirdly and finally, in the light of the tax. In the light of the tax. I'm sorry that all of my headings are so mysterious, but hopefully this will make sense. So back in chapter 12, immediately after the parable of the tenants, some of the Pharisees come to Jesus, if you remember, and they present him with a Roman denarius. And they ask the question of Jesus, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And you remember the Pharisees were asking Jesus about the Roman poll tax, and they were hoping to present a challenge to Jesus because these coins were considered blasphemous to them. And Jesus draws their attention, doesn't he, to one of the most offensive features of the coins. He says, whose likeness and inscription is this, pointing to the coins? Caesar's, they say. So these coins that are so controversial and which they're bringing to Jesus, these are coins stamped with the authority of Caesar. His image. His image alone was considered blasphemous to the Jews. But as for that inscription which Jesus draws their attention to, and clearly that the words of that inscription are quite significant here because he does point them out. Well, we know what those words are on that coin because we have some of those coins still in existence today. And those coins were inscribed with these words, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. And on the other side, high priest. You see, if that coin was offensive to some of the Jews, how much more offensive was it to a man like Jesus? Of all people, you'd have thought Jesus should have been most threatened by that coin. I mean, you could say, couldn't you, that Jesus and Caesar were vying for the same position. Both men claimed to be king. Both men claimed to be high priest. Both men were demanding allegiance from all the nations. And especially both men, according to that coin, were claiming to be sons of the divine. And it's interesting, isn't it, that Jesus doesn't actually object to paying the tax. He looks at the coin and he says, render to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And why is that? Well, I suppose for one thing, Jesus recognizes that Caesar is still God's steward. And even if he is a blasphemous steward, he still does have the right to that tax. And so he makes the point, we should be paying our taxes. But I wonder whether there is also something more which we talked about probably about a year ago when I looked at this passage. Perhaps Jesus can pay that tax happily simply because actually he's not all that flustered by what he sees on the coin. I mean, that coin is an offence, yes, but it's also very silly, isn't it? He's not flustered by that silly coin with that silly face on it and that silly little inscription claiming to be the Son of God. Because Jesus, as ever, is confident of the authority that he really has. He knows that he, and only he, is the Son of God. And compared to that, to Caesar, well, Caesar is just a little boy playing games. Caesar can have his silly coin for all I care. It doesn't threaten the real Son of God. The real Son of God will rule the nations one day, whether Caesar likes it or not. Caesar will be bowing the knee to that real Son of God. And that includes the entire Roman Empire will one day be under the heel of the Son of God. And so for that reason, Jesus is not that bothered. Now, why is any of this relevant to Mark chapter 15? Well, simply in this way. In Mark 15, we meet someone who really believes he has encountered the Son of God. And who is this man? Well, he's a Roman official. He's a centurion. He's a military commander in Caesar's armies. But now you see, he's not using that title, Son of God, with reference to Caesar. he's using it with reference to Jesus. And I think that is actually incredible when you think about it. This is a man who knows a thing or two about Caesar's power. He has lived his life under Roman rule. He has executed Roman rule himself. He has spent his life hailing Caesar and serving Caesar and speaking reverently about Caesar and trying in his own little way to win Caesar's approval, perhaps hoping to be promoted through the ranks. This is a person who until now has known of no greater living human being on earth except Caesar. For him, Caesar presides. And just as those coins tell him, if anyone's to be the son of the divine, it's Caesar. But you know, now someone else has entered this man's life. And who is that someone else? Well, to make matters even stranger, that someone else does not at first sight seem to have Caesar's kind of power. This is a man who is dying on a cross. He's helpless. He's overpowered. In fact, right now, this centurion himself is probably the highest official on the site. Probably he is overseeing this entire crucifixion. Jesus is under his care, in a manner of speaking. And yet, in spite of all that, this centurion somehow recognizes that in comparison to Jesus, Caesar is tiny. And so what does he do? He takes that grand title, Son of God, which he would have heard with reference to Caesar countless times and read on that coin again and again, and he now ascribes it to that man who has just died on the cross. And it's incredible, isn't it? Already, the nations are bowing the knee. It's a wonderful mystery. Even when Jesus looks at his weakest, he looks the most pathetic right now, more than he ever has been. He's not commanding illnesses to disappear. He's not stilling storms. He's not doing any of that. He's just died. Even when he looks at his very weakest, he is persuading Roman centurions to transfer their adoration towards Caesar and offer it to him instead. To take their coins out of their pockets and to look at them and think, Caesar, son of the divine? Nah. Jesus, he's the one who deserves that title. And this is what Mark wants you to do when you're confronted by this man on this cross. This has been his intention from the very beginning of this book. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And so I'm asking you this evening, do you respond to that man in that way? Is that the way you respond to that man dying on that cross? Is he to you just a pathetic piece of meat, a figure of the past who is there one day and gone the next and is of no relevance to you whatsoever? Or is he the Son of God? And if he is, I tell you, bow the knee to him and worship him, and he will save you. And he will welcome you to himself, and he will be your Lord and Master both now and in eternity. Amen.